Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview a dish. This is the annual Chuck Goes to Max FunCon and Does Some L.A. Shows edition. And we're going to start this one off. I was able to get three episodes in the can out there. And we're going to start this off with my good friend, Adam Pranica, of the Friendly Fire podcast, of the Greatest Generation podcast, and of Seattle, Washington. Adam picked a wonderful movie that is called Hard Eight. It is Paul Thomas Anderson's first film. We think both agree that, and I think lovers of this film agree, it's probably underseen. This is before P.T. Anderson made a big splash with Magnolia and Boogie Nights and, you know, really became one of the most revered auteurs in Hollywood. But all of it's here in Hard Eight, everyone, including the beginnings of his acting company that he started to work with on many other films. Really, really good movie. Adam is an awesome guy. I met Adam, I think, at the one of the John Hodgman Chateau Marmont hangs pre-Max FunCon quite a few years ago. And, you know, Adam's just a great guy. He's quiet, and you got to spend some time with him to get to know him. But once he trusts you, he opens up a bit, and it turns out is hysterical. I always call him the secret weapon of the Friendly Fire podcast, because Adam picks and chooses his times to jump in, and when he does, it's very funny, which is one of my favorite kinds. He's not a blowhard, everybody, like me. So here we go with Adam Pranica on Hard Eight. So
I'm going to hit the button just like get some of this.
Say what?
I feel like this might be something that you want. I'll just pre-roll.
No. You're recording, right?
I'm recording now.
Oh, you weren't getting that before? So what are we drinking?
This is a Morgan's Cup.
And what's in it?
This is gin.
Okay.
And cucumbers.
Okay, I taste that.
And lime.
A little light on the
lime. And a little bit of simple syrup.
Okay.
You want to muddle all of those together and give it a stir and throw some cracked pepper and salt on top.
Oh, nice.
You need to know when to say when on that pepper, Chuck.
I'm a black pepper guy.
Yeah? So you just have the guy at your table like for 20 minutes cranking that thing?
Cranking that long phallus over my table.
Yeah, it's a real power move, right?
That's my favorite thing. Yeah, they always do look like just big giant dicks.
They do. They don't even try to obscure the phallus.
Nope. Dress it up.
Yeah.
This is delicious. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think it's just what I needed.
Yeah.
I'm feeling tired.
It's a little pick me up.
Yeah, and this is working well. I can tell already.
That's good.
How'd the class go? Good?
Great.
Yeah?
Yeah. A lot of, you know, what we got that I wasn't expecting was the person in the class who was like, I just drink red wine.
Right.
I don't drink cocktails.
Yeah, so everyone, you know, here at Max FunCon, there are activity sessions during the day. There are two of them. Morning session and afternoon session. The afternoon session, every year, John Hodgman and I do our trivia, pub trivia. And at the same time, you and Ben Harrison, also with Friendly Fire, did a home bar class. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, how to stock and use a home bar for social situations.
Nice, and it went well?
It really did.
That's instructive.
Yeah, everyone was really game.
Cool.
Yeah, like the main takeaway is don't try to convince someone to like something just because you like it.
Yeah, what is, like, since people are listening to this, give me your top three home bar suggestions and tips.
Well, I think, like, starting with that, I think would be if you have a friend, like I have a friend who doesn't like agave spirits. Like,
sure.
This is a very close friend of mine who doesn't drink tequila. I'm not going to try to make him a tequila cocktail to try to get him on my side.
Sure. But you really got to try this one.
Right. Yeah. That's no good. Why even?
Yeah.
That would be probably tip number one. Mm-hmm. Tip number two I would say is to prepare as much as possible. And by that, I mean...
So if you're having a party.
If you're having people over, you should probably have your prep done so that you're not spending your first hour cutting limes and making simple syrup.
Right.
And ideally, and I know you've run into this at Max FunCon, like there are real life bartenders at Max FunCon who batch cocktailed everything out so that you're not getting a huge lineup when you want something to drink.
Right.
They're ready to dose things out for you and send you on your way.
All right.
So, yeah.
Tip number two.
That's two.
And what's number three?
Shoot. What is tip number three?
Or maybe for tip number three, what would be like a solid suggestion of things to have on hand for if you just want to have a cocktail, you know, party, knowing that you can't cover all the bases and make every drink under the sun, what's a solid like lineup of liquors and then accompaniments?
You know, like you and I are men of a certain age.
Okay.
And I feel like we're throwing fewer and fewer ragers in our life.
Sure.
I feel like when you've got like 4 to 6 close friends, you could make that into a fun glassware situation.
Okay.
And my wife has been great at like collecting interesting glasses from bars that go out of business and stuff.
Oh, cool.
I think like if you have a cocktail that a friend has made you in a glass that is unusual, that feels really good. And I think that makes it an occasion.
Okay.
In a
fun
way. So
break out some cool glasses.
Yeah. Break out the like the way that your parents or grandparents hoarded the china.
Right.
Like use the china
is
the lesson, I think. Like don't just stash it away. Break it out for your good friends.
All right. That's great.
Yeah.
What's your background? Where are you from?
I live in Seattle at the moment. I was born in Southern California.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and moved away fairly early in my life. I barely remember it. Moved across country to Virginia Beach.
Okay.
Where my dad worked in video production.
Oh,
and then
cool.
Moved us cross country again to Seattle.
Also
for my dad's video production.
What kind of video production? Like
corporate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they had that back then.
They did.
He was probably pioneering with the big camera that you put on your shoulder with a bag that was
contained
the tapes on the other shoulder.
Yeah. The large format.
Right.
Beta cam.
Yeah. So is that how you got into filmmaking? Is through Pops?
I think my father and I have very different levels of engagement in video and film.
Okay.
And by that, I mean, like, I think what inspired me about my dad's work is that he made it an example of something you can make a career out of.
Mm-hmm.
But you rarely ever saw the art or the joy in it.
Oh.
I think
it was corporate video.
I worked in corporate video for many years, and it is a conflict between you and your client to feel good about the creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're rarely satisfied with how that shakes out because ultimately you're not making that decision. You're serving your client.
Right.
And that can, over a number of years, like that adds up.
Yeah.
That adds up into, like, I think something that was super instructive about my relationship to my dad happened when I was in college and, which I don't know about you, but I saw maybe the most amount of films I've ever seen in those 4 years of college. I was constantly going to the movies, and this was between 97 and 2001, 2002, which was a really interesting time in movies.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the movie I went to see with my dad. My dad had come to visit me at school, and we went out to see a movie, and I was excitedly talking his ear off about this film that we were going to see.
Right.
And on, I would go about, like, this is going to be great. This is by a filmmaker I love. This is why this is important.
Yeah.
And he stopped me, and he said, it's just a movie.
Oh, man.
And it totally shut me down.
Yeah.
And I think that was very emblematic of what a corporate filmmaker gets beaten into.
Right.
I want to believe that there was joy in him and creativity in him when he like worked on that craft.
Yeah.
But by the end of it, by the end of her career, I think you might be turned into a person for whom it is just a movie. And yeah. I never wanted to lose that kind of magic.
Right.
I never wanted to lose that relationship with film. And I've tried my hardest to keep it, to defend it.
Now, do you still do corporate video or?
Like, I did
what's
for.
What's your main line of filmmaking at this point?
Well, I did for a long time, but the podcast projects that I do have like elbowed into my life and my time in such a way that.
Are you full time podcasting now?
I am.
Oh, dude, congratulations.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's been a big year for me.
Yeah, that's fucking great.
So I'm one of the hosts of Greatest Gen, which is a Star Trek podcast.
Yeah, how did
Greatest Generation?
How did that start? What was the seed of, as John Roderick calls, your Star Trek show?
Yeah. John introduced me and Ben. And
you knew John through Seattle?
I've known John for almost 20 years.
Wow.
And I am not an old man.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were just a fucking through kid. Just through the Seattle music scene.
Uh-huh.
And I was dabbling in independent film for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And if anyone has ever met John Roderick before, I think you would be captivated by the idea of a film about him.
Sure.
And that was a feeling that I had when I first met him.
Really? It's like, and I want to make a documentary about you?
That's how I felt. And I actually began shooting that film for a long time and worked on it for many years. And it's, I think a lot of documentary filmmakers, yeah, I mean, that it has not been released and no one has ever seen it is a sign of a couple of things. I think in the late 90s and the early and mid 2000s, there was such a sea change in the technology used to make independent film that most people who had shot on the industry standard digital video camera systems were happy with how things went. And by the time 2003, 2004 rolled around, all of a sudden you're looking really bad on screen. And I knew...
For shooting what, like mini DV?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so as time went on and the story went on, I became less and less satisfied with how things were looking. And...
Yeah, when technology is outpacing your film, then you're...
It's hard.
Yeah, it's tough.
It's hard, especially because a documentary asks a lot of you emotionally and with your time. Like, it is obviously unpaid work.
Sure.
And if what you're looking at is not living up to your own internal expectations, it's hard to reconcile. And so when it came time to like near a assembly, I just wasn't really happy with the film and I didn't have an ending that I like. And I am such a self-editor that I finally reached a point where I knew I wasn't going to put it out.
Right.
Maybe there will be a time where that happens, where all of a sudden there's like a nostalgia for DV.
Right.
And it won't look so weird.
Right.
But for right now, it's not in that place.
Gotcha.
And so what that turned into was a really enriching and fun friendship with our friend John Roderick.
Right.
And it's also turned into a podcast project called Friendly Fire, which we do.
Right. And then he introduced you to Ben.
And he did.
How did Greatest Gen, where was that seed? You guys aren't big Star Trek guys even, are you?
We are. That,
you are?
That started as a, you know, John looked at me and he looked at Ben and was like, you guys should be friends because we're dorks.
Yeah.
And he said, you should hang out. And so Ben was up in Seattle for a John Roderick show that I was at. And after the show, we hung out afterwards and hit it off.
That's great.
Got along great. And it was the start of a great friendship. And that friendship revealed a mutual admiration for a television show that we grew up watching.
Oh, okay. So you were really into it.
We were. Yeah, okay. This was not a thing we had to study or fake or...
Gotcha.
Or, yeah, this totally became something organic.
And really kind of blew up, right?
It did. Yeah, it was something that I never thought anyone would listen to.
Uh-huh. It's so cool.
And, yeah, it made the case for itself in that way, in a really great way, because when you're a freelancer and you are a freelance video producer especially, There are good times and there are really thin times, and it's scary. And the podcast made a case for itself in a number of ways. One of them is that, like, we're listener supported, and it's nice to, like, have a wellspring of people who love your work and support you through it.
That's cool. Yeah. And now it's to the point where you guys are going out on tour and you do rooms like 300-400 people.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
It is incredible. I never thought that we would be there or that I would be there.
Yeah.
It's so fun.
I hate that I missed you guys in Atlanta last time.
Yeah.
It's terrible timing. I was, I think, doing a show of my own in another city. Or I was out of town at the very least. I just can't remember.
Yeah, we would have loved for you to have been there. Like, Atlanta's one of those places. Like, there are many cities in the country that have a 300 to 400 cap room.
Atlanta doesn't.
Atlanta has a bar.
Yeah.
With something
Where'd
close.
You go, the Earl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was great. It's so much fun.
Yeah, Atlanta's, it's weird. We don't have, I guess there's the SCAD show theater for Savannah College of Art and Design, which is about 300, but it's not like a, like, you got to know that there's a show there that you want to go see. It's not like a prominent venue that books like 3 or 4 or 5 times a week.
Yeah.
It's very sporadic. So yeah, Atlanta weirdly has a dearth of sort of those, you know, small to mid-sized venues.
I wish I spent more time there. Honestly, yeah. We just sort of barnstormed in and then took off. But one of these days we'll do a show that you can attend and then we can have some quality Atlanta hangs.
Yes.
That would be great.
And then Friendly Fire was born. Geez, I remember 2 Max FunCons ago.
You guys, I think you were there for the pitch.
Yeah, you guys said it or had already recorded a pilot, or was it the pitch?
I think 2 years ago we were still trying to pitch John on the idea.
Okay. Was there a lot of arm twisting there?
At that point, I think the pitch was very Roderick-centric, which was like, let's hear John talk. Let's hear John tell war stories,
right,
and tell us about old war movies. And what it is now is not that.
Yeah.
It feels like all three of us bring something very different to that table.
For sure. It's a great dynamic because John is really a brilliant historian, like really knows his shit to like a staggering degree.
Yeah.
And he's always good to rely on for historical framework.
Yeah.
On your show, but you do each bring something different. But
because
I like
generally,
John, for that.
Yeah, like we are of different ages,
yeah.
And I forget a lot that Ben is younger than me by many years.
Ben?
I think Ben is 5 years younger than me.
How old are you?
40.
Okay.
So yeah, Ben's and John 35. Is 50.
Yeah. So 35, 40, and 50.
So we really approach it from different positions.
Well, and he plays the role of old curmudgeon Gen Xer.
Yeah.
He revels in that.
He is the show's grouch, which is great and welcome.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think, like, I'm sure you've run into this, like, there's an instinct to say that everything is great.
Right.
And every film should get an award.
Right.
And everyone's really trying hard to make something good.
Uh-huh.
And John really disabuses us both of that come review time. And that's really welcome. It's nice to get that mix.
Yeah, yeah. I love it, man. I mean, it's one of 3 or 4 shows that I'm always up to date on.
Wow.
That I listen to within a couple of days of release. I listen to all the episodes, and even if I don't know the film, because some people can't listen to their friends' podcasts. I've heard people say that.
Yeah.
I'm the opposite.
Yeah.
I love it because I feel like I'm hanging out with my pals.
I'm with you.
So
yeah,
I listen
feel the
to
same
Judge
way.
John Hodgman and Jesse because that show is as close as it's going to get to hanging out with those guys.
Agreed.
And same with you guys. Like, you're yourself on the show.
Yeah.
I'm going to start listening to Greatest Gen. I've never seen an episode of Star Trek.
Yeah.
But I'm going to start diving in there.
That's
I'm
a
sure
very,
I'll have fun with it.
That's a very special person that we meet after a show that says, I've never watched any of the movies
right,
or any of
guys.
The shows. Yeah. I just like hearing some friends talk.
Yeah, it's cool. I certainly don't. Like, a lot of times I have seen the war film, but I'm definitely not the guy who hears what movie you're going to talk about. And if I haven't seen it, go out and watch it before I listen.
Right.
That kind of participation is great, I'm sure, when people do that. And same with Movie Crush.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are people, I try to say ahead of time what movie, And I think if people go out and watch it beforehand, if they haven't seen it, that's great. But I definitely think you can still get a lot out of a smart, fun conversation between people.
It's really about expectations, right? I think a lot of people approach the idea of a war movie podcast and they think it's going to be a certain way.
Right.
And it is really, like, I'm shocked every week at how funny the show is.
Yeah.
Week in and week out.
Yeah, even for a film like Come and See.
Yeah.
And you guys joked about, like, geez, how are we going to even do this episode? Because that film is so, you know, devastating. It was still a funny episode.
You need to protect yourself
somehow.
And that's the way I've always done it. Like, I've always laughed my way through the hardest parts of my life.
Right. Yeah. The sad clown.
Yeah.
Well, I always say you're the secret weapon on Friendly Fire.
Oh, that's nice of you to say.
Because you pick your moments, and I don't know. I think they're always the funniest bits.
Have you ever done a show, like, I find it's very different to go from Greatest Gen, which is a two-host show, to Friendly Fire, which is a three-host show.
For you?
It feels very different to me, and a lot, like, it allows me to be more strategic and cutting with what I say.
Right.
When it's just two people, I mean, it's a,
yeah, you
gotta, like, you really weight. Share the weight.
Yeah, for
differently.
Sure. Well, I will say that the few times I've done a movie crush with two other people, it's been a little tougher.
Yeah.
Yet when we do our Friendly Fire thing with all four of us, I like have no problem with that.
It feels great.
And there are visual cues. We're all in the room together.
Yeah.
So there's sort of that thing that happens where you're sort of looking around like, all right, I can see Adam's about to talk next.
I like this tradition that we're doing of doing a movie crush crossover.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like that we're barefoot right now. Like, just to paint a picture for the listener.
Yeah, we're in my cabin.
Yeah.
Barefoot.
Yeah.
Drinking gin.
Feels nice.
I'm still a little stoned from earlier.
Fun.
I did not smoke anymore before this, although I might.
Yeah.
You never know.
We could do whatever we want here. It's your show.
Here. That's what's happening here
at
Lake Arrowhead.
Yeah.
One of the most... John and I were talking this morning. It's so fucking beautiful here.
Really
And I've been here so many years, and sometimes I forget to just sort of stop and look around at how gorgeous this spot is.
It is amazing.
It's really
especially
lovely.
Like when you start at the bottom of the mountain and you can barely see the top of it for smog.
Yeah, yeah.
You get up here, you get above it.
Uh-huh.
It is paradise.
Yeah, if you guys ever get a chance to go to Lake Arrowhead, California, go, go, go.
Agreed. Come to Max FunCon.
Yeah, come to Max Fun. So you agreed, sort of just off the top of my head here, I was like, let's do a filmmaker series, because you picked P.T. Anderson's first movie, Hard Eight, after struggling with whether or not to go with Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
And you thought, well, this one's a little underseen, so maybe we can shine a light on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, let's just do a filmmaker series, because you're one of the few people I feel like I can record remotely with and have it be fine.
Right.
So that's what we're going to do.
I can hold up my end of the bargain.
And I think we should just go in order.
Okay.
All the movie filmmaker series, I'm kind of jumping around. But since we're starting with Hard Eight, I say we just go in order.
That's appropriate. Yeah, I would love that.
Yeah, and he's one of your favorites, right?
He really is. If not one of, like, he's the favorite.
Yeah.
I think he's great.
So let's talk about him for a minute, just in general. And through the lens of Hard Eight, I guess, like, to come out onto the scene with such a ambitious, and not ambitious that this was some big movie, but it does not smack of a first film or an indie film, and it was both.
Yeah.
It feels, he was always ambitious with his camera work and with his Scorsese-inspired use of the dolly and moving the camera around.
Yeah.
He wasn't like, all right, let's just lock it down on sticks. Like Wes Anderson's first film with Bottle Rocket, let's say.
He was very brave,
yeah.
I would say, like, from jump, like, fully formed.
As a kid, like, how old was he when he directed this?
Like, in his 20s.
He had to be his mid-20s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is nuts.
Yeah, and I like, one of the stories about the production of this film is that, like, he fought a studio system for his cut.
Wow.
Like he made a 2.5-hour assembly, and Reicher was like, fuck that,
yeah.
No. And then he was like, well, I'm going to I'm going to submit to Khan and I'm going to give them my cut. And then Khan was the one who just sort of like blessed the film and the director's cut of it. And then what's a studio going to do?
Right.
And I love the audacity of a filmmaker to be like that.
Yeah.
Like I'm that confident in my vision.
Yeah. And an auteur from the beginning too.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things to do is see first films of great filmmakers and see if you can see that DNA and that genius. And sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
Most of the times you can, especially if it's, it's got to be a movie of a certain size. Like you see the DNA in a Wes Anderson's Bottle Rocket.
Right.
But he clearly didn't have the resources he needed to play in the world that he really wanted to play in.
Look, I love Wes Anderson as much as anyone.
Yeah.
But I never watch Bottle Rocket.
I love Bottle Rocket.
I'm not saying that I don't.
Yeah.
But in terms of rewatchability, I think that matters a lot.
Yeah.
And I rewatch Hard Eight quite a bit.
Yeah. So this film, the original title was Sydney.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you knew. And it stars Philip Baker Hall, who...
And the sacks under his eyes.
Yeah.
which gets second billing. Don't you just want to like curl up under one of his eyes and go take
a
nap?
It's so great. Yeah. Well, the other thing that impressed me with this movie is like the presence of mind as a 25-year-old or whatever to cast a Philip Baker Hall.
Yeah. And for Philip Baker Hall to be game for punk kid Paul Thomas Anderson.
Totally.
Like, and to allow himself to be directed.
Yeah.
Is great.
Yeah, yeah. And not just cast him, though, but like to hitch his wagon to him.
Yeah.
And be like, you're going to be in Magnolia. You're going to be in Boogie Nights. Like, he was a kid and he knew.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even know who Philip Baker Hall was before this, I don't think.
Yeah.
And he clearly like
outside
been
of Seinfeld or whatever. But like you and me both.
Great Seinfeld role.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he was the library cop, right?
He was.
In Seinfeld.
I love that Paul Thomas Anderson had the instinct to create a team of players.
Yes.
Like the Wes Anderson players, for example. And he would take these actors with him on throughout his career.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things. And I think when that doesn't happen, I think it a lot of times means that the director doesn't have a, I don't want to say camaraderie, but sometimes it might be even combative. And you just cycle through actors. I really love it when a director has a company
of
players that they take along for the ride.
It makes me feel good about that director and their ability to cultivate a relationship.
Yeah.
Because you get a lot of directors with reputations for being real ball breakers who are real my way or the highway types, like the David O. Sullivan reputation of being people who just cream their actors.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of someone who can get great performances while also being a great hang.
Right. And that's P.T. Anderson.
Yeah.
You would think.
I would think, and you hear these actors talk about him in such a way that it's a whenever, wherever situation.
Yeah. And so in this case, he has Philip Baker Hall. He had Philip Seymour Hoffman. We'll get to his role in a bit, who he used again. John C. Reilly, which he used again and again. Melora Walters is even at the very end of this.
Yeah.
Hardly recognizable as the sex worker.
Who is like the anchor of Magnolia.
Yeah, anchor of Magnolia and also in Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
And I think did he use Gwyneth again? I don't think so, did he?
No.
No.
And Gwyneth Paltrow is so great in this movie.
She really is.
Like, something has happened to her reputation lately.
Totally agreed.
But you watch her in this film, and she is really spectacular.
Yeah, you kind of forget, like, oh, wow, she was a really good actor.
Yeah.
And for better or for worse, say whatever you want to about her now and her reputation as a pain in the ass or just kind of a bougie.
She has this in her.
Rich housewife, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, for her to like, when she was younger, she had some really great roles.
Yeah, agreed.
And this is for sure one of them.
Yeah, and this era is like peak Paltrow, right?
Yeah.
Like she was working a lot, taking a lot of risks with her career.
Yep.
Doing interesting things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So the movie begins with what I call the drone dong. That sound.
Yeah.
That boom.
Clementine's
bong,
dirge.
Boom.
Yeah.
Bong.
Which comes back in Boogie Nights.
Yeah, exactly. During which scene is it in Boogie Nights? Is it?
It's when Dirk gets into the pickup truck in the parking lot,
and he cross cuts that whole.
Yeah.
Oh God, I can't wait to talk about Boogie Nights.
Me too. Yeah.
But this film opens with that effect, and it's just such a just an eerie tone setter that I guess he came up with. Is that his creation? Do you know?
Paul Thomas Anderson wanted to start this film with Hard Eight, a film by Paul Thomas Anderson, smash into movie. And one of its producers said, I get producer credit before the title, like...
Oh, right.
And, like, made that happen.
Really?
Yeah. So that's unfortunate.
Oh. So he didn't have the clout at that point even, of course.
Yeah, I mean, he's... this is his first film. He doesn't get to make that call.
Do you know what the budget was for this?
I don't. I have a feeling you'll tell me.
No, I don't even know. I thought you would have looked that up.
Oh, geez.
We'll look it up. I bet it was, not as much as you think, because it's pretty contained.
What I read was that he used some Boogie Nights money on this to finish it.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
So, he had not finished this film when he started pre-production and got a green light for Boogie Nights?
I mean, he had been seen as a wunderkind, like, early on.
Yeah, rightfully.
And had already, like, cemented a deal that would take him past this.
Gotcha.
So I'm reading $3 million budget,
okay,
and unfortunately, right. Sadly, a $222,000 box office. So a criminally underseen film.
Yeah.
And... like, I sort of understand because it's a film that's never put out on Blu-ray,
yeah,
even though Paul Thomas Anderson has said this is something that he's wanted to do.
Right.
And it's not a film that's commented on very often by PTA.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's out of any sort of shame because I think it's a great film.
Oh, yeah.
I think I would never want to speak for him, but I think the conflicts around the film and his cut versus a studio versus a title that he wanted that he didn't get.
Right.
It's got to be hard to look back on this and think about all the things that you wanted it to be and weren't.
Yeah, because it's interesting. The title originally going to be Sydney, like even just calling it that, it's a very 70s filmmaking thing.
Yeah.
To title the movie after just a character, like Norma Rae or, well, I guess Alice doesn't live here anymore. It was longer than that, but...
Shaft.
Yeah. But like Sydney is, it's a character study about this man is really what the film is.
Yeah.
And they call it Hard Eight, which is fine. That's a good title in the end.
I get it. It's snappy.
But Sydney, it's about Philip Baker Hall. It's about this mysterious guy who... you get little bits of information about him doled out throughout the film until you get a complete picture only in the very end about who this guy is. You know, he has children.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, something I'd forgotten even because they don't linger on that. And there's not like, oh, well, aren't you in touch? Or what happened? Was there a falling out? He just very briefly mentions that he has two kids that he's really not in touch with anymore.
This is such an amazing film for Philip Baker Hall. He is uniquely able to connote a feeling of like paternal love and distance, paternal distance at the same time.
Yeah.
That's magical. And John C. Reilly is uniquely suited to being like kind of a dopey son.
Yeah.
A son who needs a father.
Yeah.
And this is a through line. This is a leitmotif that you get in a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson films.
Yeah.
Like the family that you make.
It's Burt Reynolds and Dirk Diggler.
Yeah.
The same thing.
Versus the family that you're born with.
Uh-huh.
And this is something that's been interesting to me for my entire life. Like I love the idea of building close relationships with my friends
right.
that feel like families.
Yeah, same. Yeah, that's really cool. And going back and watching this again, I think it hadn't occurred to me that through line through his movies.
Yeah.
And I guess things get a little, well, actually come to think of it, like There Will Be Blood. There's a lot of weird paternal.
Yeah. Yeah, these are not smooth, well-run families where everyone's happy ever.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the thing that makes them feel the most familial, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. John C. Reilly in this movie is so great.
Yeah.
And I think it's very easy to take him for granted as an actor.
Agreed.
Because he just seems like he can go out there and be that goof, like in Step Brothers or even in Boogie Nights, he was sort of a goof and silly.
He makes me cry in Magnolia because he is such a dope in that film. But when he loses his gun.
Yeah, man.
Like, I can't, like, that scene really devastates me.
Yeah.
He really gets to the heart of someone who wants to be good and wants to be seen as capable.
Yeah.
And just can't quite make it.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially in this movie, man. He's just like. And you wonder what's going on with him and why he was chosen. Of course, we'll talk about why later on.
Yeah.
But he's just such a sad, like he has no shot on his own.
What I like about, like, this movie is successful in some ways that so many other films aren't, in that you sometimes get reflected character development with someone. And the John C. Reilly character doesn't tell his own story very much in this film.
Right.
It is Philip Baker Hall's reflection of him that does. It is Clementine telling Philip Baker Hall about how he is worshipped by him.
Right.
In a way, the John C. Reilly character is kind of a cipher.
Yeah.
And he's being described by these other characters. But I think one of the magic tricks of this film is that first scene. I don't know, how much of a gambler are you, would you say? Do you enjoy gambling in casinos or playing a card game?
Yeah, sure.
I always have been.
Yeah.
And that scene is utterly intoxicating.
Oh, yeah, man.
In the casino where Sidney teaches the John C. Reilly character how to turn chips into cash.
Yeah, like the most basic grift.
Yeah.
Is what he teaches him. The dumbest, lowest level grift. Yeah. And he teaches him this whole thing, and he works on this thing all night. And I never realized until I saw it again the other day. The payoff of that is he's in this shitty hotel room.
Yeah.
It's not like the
not even a reward.
Suite.
Yeah.
It's just like a place for him to sleep that night.
Because the film jumps in time, and then you see what a really nice suite looks like later on, which still not great.
Right. But at first, it's just like, you do all this work cashing in these chips with this grift. And you just get like a fucking double two queen beds and like a few pay-per-view movies on the house.
You know what low-key my favorite part of that, of the first third of the film is when John C. Reilly goes in for the shave in the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bathroom attendant is like, looking good. And it's not saccharine or bullshit or whatever. It's just two grown men in a bathroom commenting on the differences a shave can make.
Yeah. And well, and he puts up a bit of a fight with Philip Baker Hall with Sidney. He goes like, I was going to try and grow a beard.
That is,
and
he's just, that is every dope in college I've ever known. Like, why do you look like that? You look like shit.
Yeah. I'm kind of working on my beard. But Philip Baker Hall, he never entertains that for a second. There's no debate. He's just like I said, go in the bathroom, clean yourself up.
People make a big deal about like how much fun it is to have Mr. T as your GPS. But like, if there's ever a time to make Philip Baker Hall the voice of your AI,
that would be so
I would
great.
Obey every command from that voice. And how could you not? And that's great casting, right? Because John C. Reilly is malleable and he's listening, but also there's an authority to Philip Baker Hall that is crucial to this film working.
There is, and you really, I think that's so magnified in the scene where we first meet Jimmy, the Samuel Jackson character, because what's John C. Reilly's name in the movie? Is it John?
I think it's John.
I think it is John. He brings Jimmy around, I think, to kind of impress Sidney, but he quickly realizes like that he's made a mistake. And that Jimmy is crass for Sydney.
Doesn't that sound familiar, though? Like, haven't you, like, when I have introduced a friend to another friend and you're like, oh, shit, I never should have done this.
Yeah. And you're thinking, like, oh, you're going to love each other.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, boy.
There is such a soft power in Sydney in that moment.
Yeah.
Like, that whole, I love that it was never forgotten when Philip Baker Hall, like, asks if Jimmy works in the parking lot.
Yeah.
That is such a low-key, massive cut on a person.
Yeah.
When Jimmy says he works security.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's like, Sydney's no, like, I work inside the casino.
And
like, I'm an inside guy.
Jimmy says it then, and he says it later when he is the most angry.
Yeah, he does. He reiterates that.
Yeah.
And I love just how frank Sydney is. There's that one great line when John C. Reilly goes, yeah, Jimmy, he thinks he doesn't like him. He goes, I don't.
Yeah. Even with my closest friends, I have a hard time being that honest about mutual friends.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know?
Sydney is nothing but honest.
It's amazing. He's utterly honest, but he has so much to hide at the same time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, what a, like, can you imagine being 25 years old and making this film?
It's
such a mature,
it's utterly film. Confident.
Yeah.
And it shows an awareness of adult relationships that seems impossible as a, like,
yeah.
I was and remain an idiot about relationships to people, but as a 25-year-old, I cannot imagine having the sophistication enough to write parts like this.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I wasn't even writing scripts back then, but at 25, I would have been like, oh, I guess I'll write a movie about, like, two guys in school, like, they can't get laid or something like that. Yeah. It'll be funny.
Yeah.
And, like, I would have not have had the sophistication. I still don't, to write something this good.
That soft power that Sydney has is, yeah. I think about it all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Such a great character.
And the way he loves Clementine is so unique. Like, I feel like a lot of movies would fuck this up, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, they would unintentionally make Sydney creepy,
yep.
with Clementine especially.
Yeah.
And there is never a moment where that's on the table, up to and especially when Clementine is in John's bed.
Yeah.
And Clementine asks Sydney if he wants to fuck her.
Yep.
That scene also could turn bad. And not because Sydney would accept such an offer, but like Sydney's reaction to that could be so much worse. And because it's so paternal and loving, there's so much love in him for these broken characters.
Yeah.
It's really special what he's able to pull off, and it's a sophistication that someone of Paul Thomas Anderson's age at the time seems like magic.
Yeah, and you don't know what's going on. Like, you know that he has a son and a daughter that he is not in touch with, because there's a menace to him, and you're probably thinking, well, he probably has done something bad in his life, and we don't know it yet. And then he gets these surrogate children that he really is trying to make amends and do right by. So clearly, from the very beginning, he's trying to take care of Clementine.
He says things very specifically, like, I'm giving you all that I have.
Yes.
Everything that I have, I'm giving to you. And that is such a specificity that really dials up his magnanimity. Like, and again, like, that could be portrayed in a way that is hostile, like that sort of hostile love, especially from an older person. There's something about the mix of Philip Baker Hall and these other actors and the way he reads a line that just works.
And he does that. I mean, it would become a hallmark of PTA. He has an interesting melody to his dialogue. That's almost musical at times. And the Coen brothers kind of have that sometimes. Well, they will repeat things, or, and it would become a hallmark in PTA's work, but he, like, Sydney will say something and then say, like, do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Right.
And reiterate things. And it's just very lyrical. It's interesting.
I do this not because of this, but because of this.
It's really, it's not a very naturalistic way to write.
No, and it would clang, I feel like, in another actor or in another movie. And it really works
here. It fucking works, man.
And
he early on was just with his insert shots that he would become known for. They just, I don't know, man, they add so much just to see a close-up of the cup of coffee and the cigarette butts and the ashtray on the table in the diner. just instructs of where we are so well.
This is a look that he would carry forward for his entire career. Yeah. Those three shots to establish a scene.
Yeah, he does.
And then we're in on the characters. And that rule, he sort of has his own private rule of threes to establish a scene that I've come to just really love and appreciate.
Yeah, it is always three, isn't it?
Yeah.
Three little insert shots.
Also, I don't know how you feel about diners, but this is a great diner movie.
It's one of the great diner movies.
There are a couple of great diners in Seattle, and I think the reason I love diners is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
Those old brown hourglass mugs.
Uh-huh.
Like you can't smoke in diners in Seattle anymore, but like the vinyl booth, against a window,
And these guys that never go in there to eat anything, It's like it's always a cup of coffee and some cigarettes and like maybe a piece of pie or something.
This film tells you fairly early on that that PTA is a director with style, but he is not stylish.
Yeah,
like that cut in the car when John C. Reilly moves to the front seat.
Yeah.
Like, that's flashy for another director,
right.
But it's just style for PTA.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love that a ton, and there are some flourishes in this film that are like that.
Yeah.
Like, it's letting you know that there's someone who's like, thinking more about this stuff than usual.
Yeah.
But he's not throwing it in your face.
Yeah, and he also does that other thing, too, that I notice in all his films, where he'll have the dialogue and the score ramping up in a crescendo of intensity. Like, the way they're speaking, it matches the music. And it's really like, I'm sure other people have done that, but it feels like such a Paul Thomas Anderson thing.
He really has a command of a score's relationship to the film. And, like, there's never been a more incestuous relationship than the one in Magnolia, where they're like playing off of each other. But later on, when he's doing films like There Will Be Blood, the score to that film is almost an anti-score.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where it's almost a feeling instead of music.
Yeah.
And that is something that I feel like he's really doubled down on in his films lately. And it gives you such a feeling of discomfort.
Oh, yeah.
In moments where you should feel that way.
Uh huh.
I think he really is onto something there. And Clementine's Bells, I think, is the first instance of that. Like, when this film opens, that drone informs the rest of his career in that way.
Yeah.
Because there is something skin-crawly about how that plays out.
Yeah. And then it'll do something like Punch Drunk, which the music in that movie is like so key as well, but so different than other things. And he usually works with the great John Bryan.
Yeah.
We need to shout him out, of
absolutely.
Course.
Yeah. He's and a big part Amy of it. Mann is such a big part of his films also.
Amy Mann, who I just saw like 20 minutes ago.
The greatest. She's I love Max Funcon.
Yeah, she's here at Max Fun.
Yeah.
Amy Mann and fucking Ted Leo. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I love how, this is just a little funny side note, but how when John C. Reilly tells the story about the matchbook that caught fire in his pocket, he's telling the story that he just thinks is so great and how little fucking time Sidney has for it. He lets him get through the story, but it's not like, oh my God, really? I mean, there's zero comment on it. He's just like, okay. Well.
It's the idiosyncrasy of a dope.
Yeah.
Like, I don't use matches guy is the guy who is substituting an idiosyncrasy for having a character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in the wrong hands, like, that's dopey and dumb. But the cutaway gets me every time.
Yeah.
It's so much fun.
Oh, it is. That one cutaway where it's, is like, P.T. Anderson didn't do a lot of visual gags, so, like, for him to do that.
But in fairly quick succession, he does the move to the front seat and the match gag.
Yeah, that's
And then
true.
He doesn't fuck around with cut comedy for the rest of the film, which I think is good. Like, it's restrained.
Yeah. I thought the other interesting thing about the character of Sidney is there's how he simultaneously has menace and kindness.
Yeah.
And you don't know. You're sort of uncomfortable as a viewer because you get the feeling when John C. Reilly at the very beginning sort of hitches his train to him, it's like this guy's being nothing but kind. So why does it feel like he's making a deal with the devil?
Yeah. And that is, this is a way that I feel quite a bit. Like, I'm immediately suspicious of kindness if it's coming from someone that I don't know.
Yeah.
And this is a way that this film makes you feel uncomfortable from the start.
Yeah.
And I think it's great that you see every part of the spectrum to Sydney in this film. Uh-huh. You see him benevolent in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You see him scared when Jimmy pulls a gun on him.
That's one of the most fucked up parts of this movie.
Yeah.
Because you have seen him in nothing but complete control.
Yeah.
And when he's fucking scared, it's like hard to watch.
It is, because he feels like your dad.
Oh, God, yeah.
He totally pivots into a character you want to care for.
Yeah, man.
Even though for the first hour, he's been taking care of you and the characters that you like.
Yeah, that's why it's so hard to watch, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when he flips the switch and suddenly he's the guy waiting in the dark for Jimmy.
Yeah.
He is a like fully shaded character. He contains the entire spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, you see a role like this and you're like, all right, he could have easily won a Best Actor award for this.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the whole film was ignored, I think. I mean, it made so little splash.
Yeah.
Robert Ridgely's in it too, speaking of In the Company.
So great. Just a little bit part.
Yep. And Boogie Nights was a guy who, Emily and I,
Colonel.
Yeah, the Colonel. Emily and I quote all the time.
Yeah.
One of the things that we, movie lines that we use on each other a lot is when someone says something obvious, we'll go, oh, you think so, Doctor?
Me too. The same. And no one gets it. It's like a little thing for me.
Yeah. Oh, you think so, Doctor?
Yeah.
We say that all the fucking time.
So great.
So great. And it's funny, early on in the movie when Sydney tells John, it's a really good line, never ignore another man's courtesy. And I just, because of his voice, I wanted that to be followed with, I like simple things like lollipop in my mouth and butter in my ass.
I love the idea of taking a legacy actor like him and putting those words in his mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
It's brilliant. I can't wait to talk about Boogie Nights.
Oh, yeah. Same.
But Hard Eight is such an important and great film.
Yeah.
And it's not just a, you should really see where Paul Thomas Anderson came from, like throw it into your mix.
Yeah.
It is on its own really and legitimately a great movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And Sam Jackson, like this is one of my favorite Sam Jacksons, sort of echoes the Jackie Brown. Like he does the, when he does the small time hood thing.
Yeah.
Not even Jules. Like, Jules is even a little too polished.
Right.
There's something about this level, like the security guard guy who turns out has some compromising information on
Sydney.
He's
legitimately dangerous. And I think a scene that's so instructive about his, like, where he is in his head is that he takes the money and he gambles it.
Yeah.
He doesn't use it to better himself in any way. He uses it to play craps.
Yeah.
And you know everything you need to know about Jimmy in that moment.
Uh-huh.
Like, not only does he have the balls to hold up Sydney, which takes incredible balls, but that he would just blow it at a craps table, betting the hard way.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Taking the hard eight.
Yeah.
Was that a stolen shot? Was that Steadicam shot? A stolen shot?
I mean,
where they go through the casino like that?
In the commentary track for this film, Paul Thomas Anderson says you would have to be fucking crazy to do any sort of film in a casino. And like that, he does it and he pulls it off and he does long tracking shots there constantly in this film. I think might be like a flex that he's doing.
So those were all extras and that was all blocked and set up.
Yeah.
Wow. Because it felt like, and I knew it had to have been pretty small budget. I was like, did he just fucking like sneak a camera in and steal the shot?
There's such a look really to impressive. Dumpy casino that evokes such a feeling.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Like the downtown casino. The
and one, you like, basically open with that feeling and it informs everything else.
Yeah.
Like every dingy hotel room you end up in with Clementine.
Yeah.
Every scene of gambling. Like it's just...
These aren't the high rollers.
It's 60% fun, and the other 40% is dark and menacing.
That's Vegas to me, man.
Yeah.
That underbelly of like, there are the high rollers, but
if you get out of the lane a little bit,
or these guys like, the small time griff just trying to get a room.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the, well, we should go ahead and talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
That guy. One of the most obnoxious, hard characters to even watch that I've ever seen in a movie.
It's He's magic, so what he does. Yeah.
He's so awful. It's such a fucking dick.
There's, I mean, it almost goes without saying what a genius Philip Seymour Hoffman was.
Yeah.
And I just watched Magnolia at the Cinerama in Seattle.
Oh, nice.
Recently, they like they brought it back for a 1999 film festival.
Oh, cool.
A lot of great movies in 99. Magnolia is one of them.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but, like, I just got really emotional watching him, and
yeah,
I just really miss him as an actor. He's,
fuck yeah, man.
He's so incredible, and you see him in this scene, and he is as hateable as a person could ever be.
Yeah.
And that he's dead makes you love him in this scene.
Yeah.
It's such a weird conflict.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The way he says fuck when he doesn't hit the hard way.
Yeah.
Is, I know you've said you don't like a Vegas casino, uh-huh. And I have to admit, I do love a Vegas casino. Uh-huh. I love gambling. It's a ton of fun for me.
I'd like to go to Vegas with you. That'd be a good
that
time.
That is an actor who knows how that word is said in a gambling context.
Yeah.
Because when you don't hit something,
yeah,
it is shattering.
Yeah, it's angry, it's deflated.
Do you play craps at all?
I've played craps, yeah. Craps is... I never fully understand it. I always just was like, I'm going to learn like 4 or 5 bets.
Yeah.
And just have fun, because
that's the right way to do it.
Lot of fun.
When you and I go to Vegas, we'll roll craps.
Okay.
But the thing about craps that I know you know is that it's not just about you.
Yeah.
You feel a sense of responsibility, yeah, for everyone when you're the roller.
Especially if you get a little bit hot.
And when you're hot for a while,
yeah,
and the money starts flowing to the table,
uh-huh,
and then you crap out. It hurts.
Yeah.
In an almost primal level.
Because you've let down everyone.
And his fuck is an example,
yeah,
of that. Like, when he releases that,
oh,
like,
yeah,
you know what a gambler fuck sounds like. And he knew it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way he's laying into Sydney.
Yeah.
You feel so bad for Sydney.
Yeah.
But he's just fucking taking it all on the chin. And he bests him in the end.
It's the biggest power move you can do, the table
move.
Maximum.
Yeah. Like, he did that to fucking knock him down, didn't he?
Yeah. And that the Philip Seymour Hoffman character throws 100 on the hard way.
Yeah.
Because that's his maximum.
Right. He made him lose all his money.
Yeah. Yeah. He drew him out and then buried him.
That scene was so good.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that scene was good.
It gives me chills to talk about. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And it's so emblematic of how great Philip Seymour Hoffman would be throughout his entire career.
Yeah.
He does so much with very little.
Yeah, and I know I've heard P.T. Anderson talk about how much he loved Phil, as he called him.
Yeah.
And he said that he wrote the part of Magnolia for him. He said because that's as close to Phil as in real life.
Yeah.
He's like, he is a sweet, sweet guy. And I always make him play guys like Scotty and Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
And like this fucking guy.
Yeah.
And he said, I wanted to give him something where he could be Phil. And that his nurse character in Magnolia apparently is like as close as it got to the man.
It's such a beautiful film.
It is.
And and like tender.
Yeah. Very quickly, I do want to mention one of my other favorite little, and it's such a instructive, like, there's no throwaway shit in this movie.
It's a pretty tight 100 minutes, right?
Yeah, it's tight, but like the what you would think is a throwaway scene with John C. Reilly explaining the pay-per-view scam to Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah.
But that's so instructive that, like, this guy, he's always on the make, and he's like, oh, here's what you do. Like,
yeah,
I get two TVs in here, and I unscrew this, and then I plug it into here, and, like, and you know, it's cool. You get free movies or whatever.
Yeah. It is so quintessentially a dope trying to impress a girl he likes.
Yeah, and she's impressed.
With anything that he's good at.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if she cares.
Yeah, like, he might as well have been like, well, here's my bubblegum card collection.
Yeah. And I think we've all felt that way before around someone that we like.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what to say.
Right.
Other than the thing that I'm an expert about.
Yeah.
And that whole scene with Gwyneth and him in that hotel room, I think, is so sweet because, like...
Oh, that part, yeah.
Like, Gwyneth Paltrow in a tank top in his bed...
Yeah.
...is chaste.
Yeah.
Even though she is a sex worker.
Uh-huh.
Like, there's something so pure about their relationship in that moment.
Yeah.
It's really sweet.
It's like two kids.
Yeah.
Who never had a chance... to be kids like that, probably.
Yeah.
The scene I thought you were referencing, which we may as well talk about, the scene with when she
there's
has...
There's another hotel room that they end up
yeah,
in.
When she has a John that rips her off, and they call Sydney, and it's not revealed what's in the room.
Yeah.
Like, he won't let him in, first of all. He's on the other side of the door.
Yeah.
Like, just let me in.
One of the long tracking shots in the film is following Sydney out of his car, up the stairs of the motel, into the room.
And there's so much fucking tension
as
a viewer. And it had been so long since I saw it, I couldn't even fully remember what had gone on in there.
Yeah.
And he refuses to turn that camera around for so long. And you're just going like, what the fuck is in there?
It's such great restraint.
Oh, my God.
Because you know you have a set piece there. Like the bloody guy in a bed.
Yeah.
Like, that is a story.
Yep.
And to withhold that from us for as long as it's done, it's really great.
As a kid filmmaker, it's like, again, just amazed at the maturity and the restraint that this kid had at such a young age.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
That entire scene, it's Gwyneth Paltrow with her face in her hands the entire time. She's acting inside a bowl made out of her hands.
Yeah. God, that scene was rough.
Like, the knowledge that you know Jimmy has been there before.
Yep.
That is paid off later is also so crucial.
Yeah.
And the spectrum that Sydney goes through in that scene, he runs the whole gamut. He's
a disappointed father,
scared and angry and mad dad.
Yep. Yeah. God, that scene is tough. Cause John C. Reilly is so dumb and desperate.
Yeah.
And he slaps Clementine.
Yeah.
And like, it's all so hard to watch.
Yeah.
They're so fucking dumb. And Clementine is so upset. She's doing that. It's so real, though. She's doing that thing where she's so upset, but refuses to be smart about what the reality is.
The cruelest thing that Sydney says in the entire film is about, like, the first lesson in sex worker university is get the money up front. Oof.
First thing to teach you at hooker school.
Yeah.
Yeah, that line is fucking tough.
And it's so withering because he's the papa of the whole thing. And that's the moment he allows himself to go dark.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you realize they got married.
Yeah.
Clementine and John got married.
And it's so much sour followed by sugar, too, because what happens in the scene after that, Sydney has ostensibly fixed it, and he's telling them to go to Niagara Falls.
Right.
And then he does that refrain again.
Which John C. Reilly doesn't want to go to because he's been there before.
That's great. Like, the resistance that he puts up to that idea is, like, so
it's
dumb.
It's like, dude, fucking, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Sydney does the thing again. He's like, I'm giving you everything that I have.
Yes.
And if you ask, I will give you even more when you need it.
Yeah. And it's like, do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Yeah.
I'm willing to give you everything that I have.
Yeah.
So powerful.
It really is. It really is. And I don't know whether, like, maybe it's just like a cynicism of modern times, but in the late 90s, I never felt cynical. Like, the first time I saw this film, I never didn't trust him.
Yeah.
I never didn't think that he would come through if you were to ask him. But I feel like if you made this movie today, I think you would always be on guard against that kind of promise from a main character in a context like this.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of even threatens that a little bit. Like, no, this is too much.
Yeah.
You guys have fucked us up. But you know that he's not going to leave them.
Yeah.
Because they're his two surrogate kids.
Yeah.
There's an air of confidence in how he handles everything.
Yeah.
And like, when he throws that gun down the sewer, like, you know he's done that before.
Yeah.
and knows exactly what to do.
Yeah.
Next. And then, you know, at an hour and 20 minutes into the film, you get the big reveal that he has killed John's father.
Yeah.
And you know it's something, yeah. But you kind of forget about it for a little while. And then you're reminded, oh, right, Sidney was a fucking bad guy.
Yeah.
And he's responsible for this kid.
Just the way Jimmy puts it, like he says so much without saying anything at all. Like, I know people
yeah.
out there
yeah.
who told me about you.
Yeah.
And I don't think the film is specific in any way about what Sidney did out there.
Right.
Other than killing John's father.
Yeah, you don't know what went down or why it went
You don't
down.
Know to what degree he is connected.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter because a person like Jimmy makes it so menacing.
Yeah.
That you don't need to know any more than that.
Well, he ends up in Reno. That's instructive for a character.
Things have gone bad if you're in Reno.
Yeah. Like living in Reno.
Yeah.
Driving a Crown Victoria.
It's interesting how little Reno is as a character in this film, and Vegas too.
Yeah.
You really get it on a micro level. Like yeah. You're never seeing territorial Vegas or Reno shots.
Yeah, for sure.
You're only in the shitty casino. Uh-huh. You're only in the cars.
Yeah.
You're only in the hotel rooms.
Yeah, you're right.
And that could be a function of budget.
Right.
But I think it's more intentional than that.
Yeah.
I really think it's about, there's a little bit of claustrophobia.
Yeah. Yeah, but from the moment Jimmy says that, his fate is sealed.
And it's because Sidney is scared by it.
Yeah.
That you're told that you should be scared about this too.
Right. And Sidney knows that he has to kill him.
Yeah.
Like that's the only way around this. He's so desperate for John to not know this.
Yeah.
Like you really feel that.
Yeah.
Like with every ounce of your being as a viewer of how important it is that John not find this out.
Sidney has been the captain of every conversation he's been a part of.
Yeah.
Except with Jimmy.
Yeah.
Where he is led around by his nose.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Every character in the movie is, wants Sidney's approval.
Yeah.
Even Jimmy. Cause remember there's that point toward the end where Jimmy wants Sidney's approval even.
Yeah.
Talking about being the inside guard and that he's.
Yeah, he calls back the parking lot attendant.
Yeah, because he knows that Sidney thinks he's fucking a lowlife.
Yeah.
And he wants his approval.
Yeah.
It angers him. You can tell that's one reason he's doing this.
He's pissed off initially that the gun got thrown away, but then he's like trying to impress him again. I've got plenty more guns.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Such a weird thing.
Yeah.
It's like Sidney just has that gravitas.
Yeah.
That like everyone wants to get his approval.
There's something really aspirational about his character, and I mean that sincerely. Like an old person who is as grounded in his own character as he is,
yeah.
Who is kind, legitimately kind,
yeah.
And especially like, and I've always felt this way. Like I'm not friends with people who are unkind to people who work in restaurants
right.
or who work in retail. Mm-hmm. He's that guy. He's mm-hmm. the guy you aspire to be, who yeah. is. Who is a good person to people in service right. and industry jobs.
Yeah.
And that informs a lot about his character
yeah.
to you as a viewer.
Yeah, because he has that conversation, that great conversation with Clementine early on.
Yeah.
When he talks about, you know.
What would happen if you weren't so nice?
Yeah, and he makes it very clear where he stands. Like,
yeah.
You don't have to do that with me.
You know what, low-key, one of my favorite scenes in this film is that when someone else calls him Captain.
Yeah.
And he says, that is Clementine's name for me.
Yeah.
I love that moment.
Yeah, that's pretty good. It's like, that's what my daughter calls me,
yeah.
basically.
That's reserved.
Well, you know, we find out that he is responsible for this, and now it all sort of makes sense on why you felt this menace from someone who is really nothing but kind.
Yeah.
Throughout
he's capable
the film.
Of more.
Yes, he's capable of much, much more. And John's dad is just the tip of the iceberg. You get the feeling. You know,
do you think it's best that we never know him?
I
kind of
so.
Do.
Yeah.
I feel like you're able to understand what he might be like through mm-hmm. John, and that's all you need.
Yeah, because you would lose. It's weird, like a magic trick of this film is even once you find out about John, you still have sympathy for him.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's probably something he didn't even want to do. Maybe he had to do it.
Yeah.
And if you knew more, and let's say you found out that Sydney was a fucking cleaner or just, you know,
yeah,
someone for the mob who took out motherfuckers left and right, you probably would lose some respect for him.
Right.
But you still, because you don't know, and he doles out such little information, you're still able to retain this, like, sympathy for this guy.
Yeah.
Who ended up in Reno trying to take care of the kid whose dad he killed.
He is a really special character.
Yeah.
In all of movies, I think he's unique.
Yeah, which is why it should have been called Sydney.
Agreed.
Such a character study.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
You know? And then, you know, boy, he fucking takes Jimmy out like a fucking boss. Like, pro. Goes over, sits in that goddamn chair with Jimmy's gun.
Yeah.
You know, like, he knows exactly what he's doing.
There's a moment of vanity in that scene that is so subtle, where Sydney sits in the chair and he's got the gun.
Yeah.
And he kind of considers how he looks in the chair.
Yeah.
Do you notice that part?
Yeah.
Where he sort of like practices aiming.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, that's really cool too, because this may have been something that he did a long time ago, and
right,
he just needs to get used to the idea again.
Yeah. Right. It's probably been a long time.
Really fun.
Since he shot a guy.
Yeah. And that's Melora Walters as the girl that Jimmy brings home after that night playing craps.
Yeah.
And she plays such a little part in this film. And it's a real, like, blink if you miss her moment.
Yeah.
But God, she would go on to do great things. I'm such a huge fan of hers.
Yeah, she's great. And I love in that scene, never for a second do you think that he's going to kill her.
No.
You know he's going to let her go. Because he's been around the block and he knows.
Sydney's got a code.
He's got a code, but he also knows, like, she's not a threat to him.
She's not going to tell.
She's not going to tell. She's not going to go to the fucking cops and say, you know, this low-life security guard got killed. She just wants to go home.
What do you make of Sydney very specifically shooting him in the dick?
Oh, he did.
Because he double taps the chest and then he does go down to the dick.
Oh, is that what he does?
Yeah.
I don't think I caught that.
I mean, you could read it as the body falls, but
he shoots him in the dick.
I think I feel like he shoots him in the dick.
I don't know. Maybe that's it could be interpreted a couple of ways. Maybe that's his signature move. If he was a
hitman. That's the Sydney.
That's the Sydney. Two in the head, one in the dick.
Yeah.
Or just his utter disgust for this guy.
Yeah.
And so little regard that he neuters him.
You know, we talked a lot about like the sound in this film and Clementine's bells being a part of it, but the leather sound that Jimmy comes with is such a menacing thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He's always wearing those gloves. They're always squeaking.
Yeah.
He's always wearing that jacket.
Uh-huh.
When he enters the room and gets shot by Sydney, like, you can hear him move.
Yeah.
There's that sound of that leather to him. Like,
it's
there's a lot going on there. When you sketch out a character, it's how he looks, how he talks, but also how he sounds.
Yeah. Yeah, and Sydney just owns him.
Yeah.
The whole fucking time. Even when there's that one break where Sydney is scared when he has the gun on him. That's hard
But you could write the film paper that he is not, and that's he's playing.
And I kind of wondered that because it's so out of character.
Yeah.
I wondered, is he giving him like, all right, I'm going to let him have the power right now and think that he's got me.
The way I've always read
it
is that those were legitimate fears that he was displaying.
Oh, really?
But I could definitely read it the other way.
For sure.
Yeah.
Because he's fucking
way
smarter
than Jimmy.
He's never not in
control. Yeah.
And he's always one step ahead.
I love how they drive the car to the turnaround in the casino right after that scene.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they drive it 50 feet into the turnaround and get out, and then they go to Sydney's apartment to get the cash.
Right. And Sydney, too, won't stop smoking in the car, too, which is another power move.
That is so great.
Yeah,
a gun to him.
Out. Yeah. He's like, no, I'm not doing it.
So much fun.
Yeah, man. Such a great movie.
It is really great.
That last shot, you know, and then the cat in the diner again with that, just that blood on his sleeve.
Back to one.
Yep, back to one. And he pulls his suit jacket down to cover the blood on his shirt sleeve. So great. Such a great way to end that movie.
I agree. It's really special.
Yeah.
It's like, for a film that is punctuated by the sort of violence that it has,
yeah,
it is so quiet and small most of the time.
Yeah.
And it is really about our core characters, yep, and what they're going
study.
Through.
Uh-huh.
And it's so mature for a young filmmaker.
Yeah.
It's just really special.
Yeah. I can't wait till we get into Magnolia, because I just am now recalling William H. Macy's character in that
movie. It's a distillation of these themes.
Yeah.
Like, can you make it even more concentrated?
Right.
And bigger somehow.
Yeah.
And that's what Magnolia does. Hard Eight is a great answer to the question, like, what's a film that I haven't seen before that I should?
Right.
This is frequently my answer to that question.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and two, Jimmy Gator is mentioned in this movie.
Yeah, Floyd Gondoli, too.
All right, who's Floyd Gondoli?
Floyd is the Philip Baker Hall character in Boogie Nights.
Oh, okay.
The guy who wants to meet
Jimmy Gator,
meet boys, meet girls. They're about to shoot to videotape.
Right.
And,
but he's Jimmy
and
Gator
it's
in
the
Magnolia,
Colonel.
Right?
What's that?
But he's Jimmy Gator in Magnolia, right? Isn't
yeah,
that his character's
yeah, yeah.
name?
Yeah, as the host of the kid show, of
yeah,
the trivia
interesting.
Show.
Interesting. So he just yeah. brings back those character names?
Yeah. Yeah, which is fun. It's fun that there's like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there is a Paul Thomas Anderson
right.
Cinematic Universe.
Yeah. God, he's a guy that you just wonder what he's going to do next.
He's on a very short list for me where wherever, whenever, like it doesn't matter
yeah.
what the film is, I'm going to go see it opening night.
Well, he did these films that kind of have a similar vibe, like Magnolia and Boogie Nights and Hard Eight. I think they're certainly not the same film.
Yeah.
But when he really took a turn when he started doing things like There Will Be Blood and The Master
yeah.
is when... Punch Drunk Love aside,
yeah,
which I've already covered on the show, but you and I should talk about it anyway.
Agreed.
Man, just what's he going to do next? I always want to know.
Can't wait. And as we've mentioned, he's a young guy. I hope we have 40
yeah.
more years of great films from him.
Yeah, and he doesn't do one of those things where he's like, oh, I'm going to retire. I've made my 8 films.
He seems like, and this is like his story, he's someone who like his dad bought him the video camera when he was 8. Like
yeah.
he's someone who's in it for the love of it. And that's what makes me confident that he will keep creating as
yeah.
long as he wants to. And
I think so.
It makes me grateful for it because
yeah.
he's a filmmaker who's doing it for the right reason.
Right. All right, dude. Well, let's since this is your first appearance, let's do the 5 questions.
Oh, I did not prepare for 5 questions. So
yeah.
what's it going to be?
Did we do this? Did we do this last year? I don't remember.
I think in a friendly fire context we did, but I've never been put on the spot.
All right. Well, let's do
like
it
this.
Again. What's
yeah.
the what's the first movie you saw in a theater?
The first movie that I can remember
that
seeing
you have
in a theater
a memory of, yeah.
was the Keaton Batman.
Hmm.
And I remember going to that film with my dad, and correct me if I'm wrong, but was that PG-13? I feel like it was PG-13.
I don't know.
I remember that being a thing.
Uh-huh.
And me being younger than 13 was sort of like I feel like my dad was doing the cool dad thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
like, that's hey,
sure.
this is going to be fun. You're going with your dad to see the Keaton Batman.
Right.
And it may be a little deeper of a pool than you're used to.
Right.
And it was so much fun.
Yeah.
And like I think that was the first time. The first like I know I saw films in theaters younger. I'm fairly confident my parents took me to see E.T., for example.
Right.
But like the idea that my mind could be fully formed in a way to like really appreciate a
yeah.
film in a theater and get it.
Yeah.
In a sophisticated way. That was the one that sticks out to me as like very formative.
Right. All right. First R-rated movie.
Speed. And I snuck into it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember the movie that I bought a ticket to,
uh-huh.
but I very clearly went with a group of friends and then snuck out of the theater and into Speed.
Yeah. I saw that again within the last couple of years and was like, I kind of enjoyed watching it.
Does it hold up? I haven't seen it in a long time.
It's a pretty fun movie.
Yeah, I bet it is.
I like Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
I'll just watch him in whatever now. He was a lot of fun in that movie.
Yeah.
Dennis Hopper was great. It was good.
Yeah.
It was a fun movie.
Shoot the Hostage.
Oh, that's right. Number three, Will You Walk Out of a Bad Movie?
And
do you have a story?
I have. I think I told this on the Friendly Fire show, which was Chris Farley's last movie.
Right.
Was the only film I've ever walked out of.
I remember that now, because it was sad.
Yeah, like, you could... The struggle was suggested for a while up until then, and I had been such a fan up to that point. I remain a fan, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I always, like, even his last SNL appearance was really hard to watch. But that last film, he was so, like, he was so shattered in it and was so clearly just hanging on.
Yeah.
That I didn't want to ever, like, you could see his death coming in that film.
Yeah.
And I did not want to remember him that way.
Right.
And I left the movie fairly early. Like, maybe at the 30 or 40 minute mark, I just didn't want to see him like that. I wanted to remember all the things I loved about him.
Yeah. That's
and
great.
I think that was a self-defense mechanism that served me, because I have not gone back to that movie, and I won't.
No.
Like, I want to remember the good times with him.
Yeah. When you guys were pals.
I mean, that's it. It's said all the time, like, your favorite SNL cast is the one you went to high school with. And
oh, interesting. I never heard that.
He was in my cast. Like, that's...
Yeah.
That's when it started. And I was his and he was mine for the entire way.
Number four, I tailored to the guest, and I'm going to go with, what film as a director do you most wish you could have? I usually say, what film do you most wish you could have made? But I'll change that up and say, what film do you most wish you could have worked on and been there while it was happening? You're not the director, but, like, you were there when they made Raiders or something.
Wow. That's a really fun question. Shoot. You know, a film I watch from time to time that I think very few people know about or talk about is Forrest Whitaker's Ghost Dog, the Jim Jarmusch film.
Yeah, fucking love Ghost Dog.
I would really have loved to have seen that interaction between Forrest Whitaker and Jim Jarmusch. And, like, to see where that character came from and where the tension was between direction and action.
Uh-huh. The Way of the Samurai.
That's the first thing that comes to mind. There are probably 100 films that I would feel that way about.
That's a good answer, though.
That's the first one that comes to mind, because that is so much fun and such an example of the film that could have gone into the ditch and had been like, shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Like something to laugh at.
Yeah.
But that is not a funny movie, other than the moments where it's intentionally funny.
Right.
And I think that is a great command.
Of
that
man.
Genre.
I'd love to see him at work.
Yeah.
And then finally, number five, what's your movie going routine?
I like the late 90s were the salad days for me, where I would go see three films a week in the smallest theater in Seattle and, like, cut out of college and go watch them.
Because if I remember correctly, you hate when people talk to you in a movie, right?
Anymore, I try not to see a film on opening weekend,
right.
And I try to go, like, 4 weeks later in a smaller theater where I can sit in the back and, like, really be undisturbed.
So you just want it to yourself.
I want to believe I'm not a crank,
right?
But the way I describe myself says crank.
Right.
Like, I just want to be left alone in a theater that I'm in by myself.
Well, maybe you're a movie crank, but you're not a life crank.
Yeah, and, like, that's the way I like to see a film. I just want to, be left alone, and like, I really still sincerely believe in the power of a movie.
Yeah.
And I like giving myself entirely to it.
Right.
In a full, like, every sense experience kind of way.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be talked to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear the crinkling of someone's candy.
Right.
I don't want someone farting or shitting in the theater. Right. Like all of the senses, like I just want, like I want to give myself over to it. And yeah. I think my favorite film experiences have been the kind where that's successful, where I can get inside it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
I love this. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah. We'll hook up over the airwaves remotely.
Yeah.
And we'll do Boogie Nights next.
This is going to be a great project.
It is. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, Chuck.
All right, Movie Crushers. I hope you liked that one as much as I did. And boy, we're going to just make this into a filmmaker series, because not a ton of people I feel like I could record remotely with and have it be just as good as being in person. But Adam and I definitely are friends enough to where we can record remotely. So that's what we're going to do. He's set up there in Seattle. We're going to keep it rolling with Boogie Nights and Magnolia. And I think we may even do Punch Drunk Love, even though that has already been done at our live Sketchfest show with Tony Hale a couple of years ago. Enjoyed that, but I think we need to stay true to the filmmaker series and cover them all. So we're going to get going with P.T. Anderson. I hope you enjoyed listening to Adam. You can follow him on Twitter, at cut4time. That is the at symbol, C-U-T-F-O-R-T-I-M-E, which is kind of a funny joke now that I think of it. Adam, Cut for Time would be a good nickname for him. So check him out there, or you can follow the Friendly Fire podcast on Facebook. It's wonderful. Those guys are all my buds, and it's a podcast I listen to every week myself. So if you're into movies, especially war movies, go check out Friendly Fire on the awesome, awesome Max Fun Network. So that is it for me, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this cabin session, and we'll see you next week. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.